I'm Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel, that's at 7 p.m., and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up for this week. And, of course, we are in the middle of this coronavirus pandemic, and we are trying to, all of us are trying to make sense out of it and to, well, I guess you could say we're trying to develop a way for us to deal with it in the immediate future. We need to deal with it in the here and now, and then as we do that, we need to simultaneously consider a pathway forward and have some idea of what is the target, what is the future destination, what is the future condition by which we would like to have occur in the near term, and of course, midterm and long term as well. So it's something that I call big picture thinking. It looks at things from a number of perspectives simultaneously, and I know that's a bit of a, you know, a bit of a stretch for some. I don't mean that in any kind of condescending way. I just mean that in terms of all of us, including myself, that it is a bit of an intellectual challenge for us to look at all of these things simultaneously. And what are they again? They are, I guess you could say that if I was taking a chapter from Victor Davis Hanson, I guess you would say that we need to have a historical perspective first and foremost. We need to know where we have been. And then the second thing is we need to know where we are right now. And the third thing is to where we would like to be or where we expect to be or where circumstances will place us in the future, in the near-term future, mid-term future, as well as long-term future. So we have the future projection. It's also called forecasting, and that was recently pointed out by another of these endless studies, and I'm sorry, I don't have the name of the study in front of me right now, but it has a recent study forecasting or projection is one of the key skills to leadership that keeps popping up. And that's our challenge as well. Okay, so how do we do all of that? How do we do that? How do we create the big picture with all of those things, all those moving parts working? They are working. They are giving us information. They are providing us with an opportunity to broaden our comprehension or to achieve comprehension. And that is something that, you know, that we are particularly concerned about in the world of Throttle Up. We call it, it is, in fact, my favorite term is higher order reasoning. And that embraces or that enables us to achieve meaningful comprehension of what is going on in our lives or in the lives of the community or the country, the civilization, as well as the world. So that's what we're trying to do here. So we are about midway. I think probably we are past the midway point of this pandemic. We are moving toward the end of the initial phase of it. We're quickly moving into phase two. I think in some cases, you could argue that we're already there in phase two. I know that in some states, things have begun to relax and open up in some form or fashion, and people are either getting back to business or they are preparing themselves to quickly reengage their business type of thinking, as well as reposition their families to deal with a return to some form of, and I hate to use the term normalcy because it's not particularly important here. I'm not sure that, you know, in a certain sense that things will ever return to quote unquote normal, but they will return to a place in which we can thrive and prosper. And what is that? I think that will be somewhat different. If I had to identify these things off the cuff, and assuming here that we are engaged in a conversation, and, you know, Throttle Up is basically a conversation. I'm not just a mouthpiece putting off platitudes and stuff like that, but it's a conversation. If we are engaged in a conversation, I would say that the new position or the new normal or the situation in which we are moving such that we can survive, we can thrive, we can prosper, and we can be productive in the long term and do good things, do things that are beneficial to ourselves and others. Okay, what is that? I would say the first order of business is that we really need to rethink our whole approach to intelligence and intelligence gathering, the institutions that we have created that are supposed to be able to warn us of impending disasters so that we can avert those disasters and catastrophes. They simply didn't work in this case. And you can say, okay, well, this is different than what they were designed to do. And I would point out that that's kind of a weak excuse. They are there to warn us of impending existential threats, and they weren't there. So am I being overly critical? No, well, I don't think so. They weren't there, and they should have been. However you want to describe the situation, you know, a lot of people are trying to convince us, the average American, that this was a one-off event. This was an unforeseen circumstance that could not be predicted. And it was a virus that occurred naturally in the natural world and so forth and so on. Frankly, I think all of that is a cop-out. I think that is an example of weak thinking, or is an example of not being able to think critically. And we are all about that. We are all about critical thinking here on Throttle Up Radio and Podcast. And so I would suggest, and I don't mean to be overly demanding here, but I would suggest that all of us reconsider our thinking in terms of its inevitability or its inability for us to have gotten early warning signs that something like this could happen in the near term, and it could be devastating to our way of life, our economy, as well as the world economic system, which it has. It has been one of the most devastating things that really has ever occurred in modern times. So that's my take on it. Do want to cover a couple of things here in terms of trying to understand it better so that we can create a better future for us. Looking at it, trying to comprehend it, but doing it in a way that, okay, something like this should never have occurred in the first place. And what do we need to do to ensure that it doesn't happen again? What kinds of things do we need to have in place in terms of physical and intellectual resources? And those things work together. The physical resources, as you will probably already know, are things like virus testing, ventilators, other medical equipment, protective clothing, specialized hospitals and specialized ICUs and what have you, and healthcare worker training, protection, and enthusiastic support for all of our marvelous people, all of our healthcare workers. And I would even go so far as to suggest that we ought to look at, because these people are so vital to our well-being, they're so vital, we ought to be looking at perhaps even improving the compensation packages of all healthcare workers. We ought to do that as a culture, as a society, and say our healthcare workers are so important to us that we would expect the compensation package that we provide these healthcare workers to be quite exceptional in the giant scheme of things. Okay, so intellectual resources. Let me read this from the Wall Street Journal Review and Outlook section, Saturday, Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd. Drug innovation to the rescue. The world hasn't had much good news of late, but some arrived on Friday as the Food and Drug Administration approved the emergency use of the drug remdesivir to treat COVID-19 patients. This underscores that drug innovation, especially by private American companies, is the best hope we have for defeating the coronavirus. Notice those two words. Innovation is the best hope. Innovation. You know, I mean, I'm not the only one. And so I don't really need to take credit. I don't want to take credit. But of course, I've been preaching innovation for a very, very long period of time. And how do we achieve that as an individual? How do we achieve innovation in our organizations and our communities and our government? Developed by Gilead Sciences, the biotech firm Remdesivir helped to reduce the length of hospital stays in some COVID-19 patients. While those results are preliminary and a much larger trial is underway, the FDA was right to allow the drug's use for patients who have little recourse. Until a vaccine is discovered, better treatments will be our main medical defense against the disease. John Cogan, a Gilead director, and George Shultz described in a companion article the long process of risk-taking that brought remdesivir to this point. They don't say, but we will, that one reason Gilead had been able to bet on the drug is the profits it has made on other drugs. One of those drugs is Sovaldi, which essentially cures hepatitis C. The left denounced Gilead when it charged $84,000 for a full course of Sovaldi, and governors complained, but Sovaldi and other competing Hep C treatments have more than paid for themselves in the money they have helped save for Medicaid by reducing long-term liver disease. America's political class, from Bernie Sanders on the left to President Trump, like to denounce drug companies as profiteers and propose price controls. I would question that statement there in terms of President Trump, but let me continue. But the U.S. drug patent and market pricing system is providing in the coronavirus pandemic that it is an invaluable national resource. Okay, I would agree with that. I think we have to look at that as such. Let me continue. From the rapid tests developed by Abbott Labs to Gilead's potential treatment and perhaps eventually a vaccine. Thank heavens the politicians haven't succeeded, at least not yet, in stifling the innovation that may save millions of lives. And I would, you know, I would say that first and foremost, I would have written it a bit differently, but nevertheless, okay, I would agree with that, that we don't want to stifle. Not only do we not want to stifle innovation, we want to make sure that innovation, the potential for innovation, is alive and well. We want to do that. So let me segue into this. Remdesivir affirms the American way. It's an article by John Cogan and George P. Shultz. The Food and Drug Administration says, it says here, has authorized the use of Gilead's drug remdesivir to treat severely ill COVID-19 patients. Previously, Gilead announced that it was donating all of its existing supply, 1.5 million doses, free of charge. That's quite extraordinary, frankly. The FDA's emergency use authorization and the company's extraordinary action gave a tremendous boost to a world in crisis. Painstaking science has been the biggest factor in remdesivir's success so far, but American markets and legal systems also helped Gilead make this contribution to human health. In this system, privately owned biotech and pharmaceutical companies financed by investor capital seek to invent, develop, and distribute new medications. Patent protection provides drug companies with additional incentives over and above those normally provided by the market to undertake the necessary risks. The incentives come from governmental protection of intellectual property and the associated ability temporarily to charge prices above the margin cost of production. Even so, drug companies and their investors reap rewards from their successes and suffer losses when their efforts fail. Drug development is fundamentally a process of discovery. Scientists discover what works against disease and how to formulate chemical and biological compounds that deliver medicines to patients. To continue discovering new drugs, pharmaceutical companies must cover the cost of the inevitable failures. About 70% of drugs never make it to the market because they prove ineffective or too toxic. Drugs typically gain approval only after many years of development, charging more than the cost of production at a price customers are willing to pay allows developers to recoup these costs. Remdesivir is a case in point. Gilead scientists determined more than a decade ago that the drug would be an effective antiviral and tested its effects on various viruses. Research on remdesivir as a treatment for childhood respiratory diseases began in 2010. Though the drug ultimately failed in that purpose, Gilead continued to research its potential. Several years later, the company discovered that the drug might work against Ebola, but after several remarkable individual success stories, the drug again failed to live up to its promise. Fortunately for patients, other drugs became available. Despite the setback, Gilead continues its research. Its scientists uncovered evidence that remdesivir might work against two coronaviruses, those behind SARS and MERS. But with the major outbreaks of those diseases having passed, there weren't enough patients for pivotal human trials. When the novel coronavirus was identified a few months ago, Gilead immediately began working with the FDA along with other health agencies in the U.S. and worldwide to expedite human trials of remdesivir. Meanwhile, FDA approved compassionate use access to the drug for more than 2,000 gravely ill patients. Thus, the FDA's emergency approval of remdesivir comes after more than a decade of dedicated research, overcoming failures, and making costly investments. The long-term development time, unexpected setbacks, and mounting costs are the norm in drug development. The costs are funded by reinvested profits and support by risk-taking shareholders with a long-time horizon. America's laws and market system, which let companies like Gilead temporarily set prices above the cost of production in normal times, enabled the development and the donation of this potent treatment for the novel virus. It goes on to say that progressive politicians and critics of the pharmaceutical industry have proposed a national price control policy as part of a government-controlled healthcare system. They seize on the difference between the price companies charge for a drug and their cost of producing it, which can be substantial. To claim that pharmaceutical companies are profiteering at the expense of patients, the critics misunderstand drug development, ignoring the R&D cost behind the drug, and more important, the cost of all companies' other drugs that have never made it through the discovery process. By eliminating the profits that fund discovery, price controls would stifle the innovation drug developers have sustained for more than a century. The eventual outcome would be fewer life-saving drugs. if industry critics and progressive politicians had their way years ago, remdesivir likely would not be available today. Careful science, the private market, and the American legal system have produced a long line of advances against disease, including an extraordinary array of medications to fight bacterial infections, cancer, cardiovascular disease, HIV/AIDS, hepatitis, cystic fibrosis, kidney disease, rheumatoid arthritis, and many more killers. Remdesivir is the latest contribution to this progress. Okay, that ends the piece in the Wall Street Journal that was published recently to explain what this pharmaceutical, well, this promising pharmaceutical product is, has for us in the current and the near term. It does appear, from what I gather from many, many sources, it does appear that remdesivir is, in fact, a viable medication that can significantly improve the severe coronavirus infection outcomes, as well as hydroxychloroquine as another drug that has, you know, it's gotten some near-term, some negative press, but it largely, the negative press has largely been considered by some very reliable sources to be fake news. This drug also has shown to be quite effective. It started out as an anti-malaria drug, but it does seem to be quite effective in reducing the severity of the coronavirus infection. Okay, now we are going to take a short break, and then we're going to listen to some few audio clips that I think are particularly important today as we move into phase two, the recovery phase of this coronavirus pandemic. I hope all of you out there are feeling encouraged, as I am, that we are seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. We are now in the process of returning this economy to its productive capabilities. We're not going to achieve full productive capacity for a while, but hopefully it will be sooner rather than later. Okay, be right back. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up, and we're going to be playing now a audio clip. This is a little bit long, but you know, I kind of think that it's important as well. This is what other people are thinking. These are some of the thought leaders. This is from a program that is actually called American Thought Leaders, and it deals with, let's see. Okay, American Thought Leaders is produced, it's by the Epoc Times, and they bring in experts from time to time. If I remember right, they produce an episode a week, and they bring in some noted experts to discuss things in a more of an in-depth way. I actually think that it's a pretty good piece of work. It's a good production. It is informative. This is what other people are thinking. I know that in a lot of radio shows, they will play audio clips, but they're rather short. I tend to like the longer version because it is it provides us with a little bit more information. It's more in-depth. I particularly like the Systems Innovation series. They're not terribly long. They run about 10 minutes, sometimes a little bit less. And those are good in terms of getting to some depth of understanding. Here is a particularly good one to help us get to the depth of understanding of what exactly happened and how should we think about this coronavirus from a global perspective. All right, so here it is. We're going to start off with American thought leaders. And let's see, the individual is Stephen Yates, who used to work in the administration in the early 2000s, I believe. So he is a rather noted expert in international affairs. Okay, here we go.
I think they might be looking more at a Tiananmen-like scenario from their own people, in that there's got to be exceedingly high unreported unemployment. And the families that have been affected by this are going to feel the pain of that impact for a long time. And I just believe in the current era, it's going to be harder, even though China maintains amazingly effective controls over information. It's going to be harder for them to conceal the realities of this than it has been for them to whitewash the realities and legacy of Tiananmen.
Just what is the significance of Deputy National Security Advisor Matt Pottinger recently giving a speech from the White House in fluent Mandarin? How does this coronavirus outbreak expose the dangers posed by China's communist regime and its authoritarian system? And with mounting global criticism of the Chinese regime, will this be a Tiananmen-like moment for China, with countries around the world sanctioning the regime for its massacre of student protesters? In this episode, we sit down with Steve Yates, CEO of DC International Advisory. Fluent in Mandarin Chinese, he previously served in the White House as deputy assistant to the vice president from 2001 to 2005, with a focus on national security affairs. This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Kelik. Steve Yates, such a pleasure to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Thank you for having me.
So, Steve, we're in very interesting times here. We have the so-called wolf warrior Chinese diplomats around the world, including in the U.S., doing what I would argue very undiplomatic things, saying very undiplomatic things, to put it lightly. At this time, you know, it's a curious day, May 4th. We have Deputy National Security Advisor Matt Pottinger appear on video speaking fluent Chinese with an unprecedented message. And, you know, you actually alerted me to this just a little while ago before this happened, which I immensely appreciated. And tell me what you're seeing with this. I mean, this is incredible stuff.
Well, it was unprecedented in my experience. I spent 5 years in the White House, and I've tried to watch the administration before and those who've come since. And I don't think we've ever had this high ranking of a national security official who was truly fluent in Chinese and then made good official strategic use of that language ability. I was a deputy national security advisor to the vice president, a very different role. So Matt has a unique life experience. I think what we saw on display, given he has some experience as a journalist, he's a very good communicator. And he did a very good job of putting together what I think is a very powerful narrative, one that I think should connect with Chinese people. And so he did, with regard to communicating to China, what I think President Trump does in communicating with Americans, which is to go around the big media. And so Matt Pottinger, I should say, instead of being so familiar with him, the Deputy National Security Advisor, he gave a remarkable address talking about the May 4th movement. It's 101 years ago today, largely focused on citizen-led, reform-minded governance in China. And so Matt not only spoke in fluent Chinese linguistically, he spoke in fluent Chinese history in a way that kind of took a giant leap past the 70 plus years of communist censorship that tried to whitewash the Republican era intellectual debate in China, pretending as if it was just the imperial era. And then there was a corrupt Chiang Kai-shek regime, and then Mao and his revolution came to save the day. when Matt was, I think, in very effective detail talking about the politics of that time that I think accurately represent the aspirations of Chinese people. And so in our exchange, I noted an irony that probably comes across more clearly in English than in Chinese, but we have a white man in the White House speaking in Chinese about Chinese history in a way that is probably more effective and fluent than most Chinese officials are able to do. And so I thought it was an amazing example of strategic communication, but it was a very, very important message in terms of content, basically saying that the ideals of democracy and freedom are very well grounded in China's intellectual tradition. And he cited Hu Shi and Lu Xun and some other writers that any Chinese educated intellectual would know, and asked what I thought was a provocative but profound and appropriate question of, it's been a century since the May 4th movement. Will the Chinese people have to wait another century to be able to reach these aspirations? Or the Chinese Communist Party get out of the way of the information control, disinformation, and deception business, and basically respect these traditions? So I thought it was incredibly compelling. I've never heard an American official speak this directly in Chinese this effectively.
You know, in my Twitter feed, I kind of live tweeted this thing. And in my Twitter feed, someone that we communicate often publicly that way, Salman Yue, he mentioned he felt like this is the basically akin to Reagan's call to Gorbachev to tear down this wall. What do you think about that?
Well, Solomon is a friend and a colleague. I served on the Republican National Committee together with him. And we often do refer to the Chinese Communist Party as an evil empire, and that this is the evil empire of our time that needs to be overcome. And it's not meant to be put in a combative or negative way that it's an American operation. It's really about, as Matt was talking about, appealing to the history, culture, and sensibilities of the Chinese people and saying, we look forward to celebrating your success in meeting those aspirations. That includes economic development, but also these other human values. The fact that there was a role in Chinese leadership defining international, global standards for human rights and democracy, it's just a profound part of the history that has been lost from the narrative, frankly, from the Henry Kissinger opening until now, where people basically accepted the Communist Party of China as the government of China, instead of basically the ruling party of a time, which is really more consistent with Chinese history.
You know, it's very interesting because even there, Matt Pottinger, he references this idea that this idea of freedom actually even predates the May 4th movement. This is something that comes out of Chinese history, and also just this kind of desire for a plurality of voices. That was something that was very strong in the speech. And because that, you know, we can kind of see today in the time of coronavirus what the cost of the lack of that is.
Right. And that's a point I think that Matt drove home very, very clearly. Some of us do it more bluntly in talking about it. I thought he was very diplomatic, frankly, and basically making clear and acknowledging that no one has suffered more in reality, but also in an opportunity cost, than the Chinese people have. No matter what anyone wants to say about the Chinese people having grown up out of poverty, well, that poverty was imposed upon them by bad government, in many cases based on Chinese Communist Party policies. In fact, in part of the speech today, Matt Pottinger made reference to Mao Zedong's reaction to some of these May 4th movement writers when asked if they were alive today, meaning during Mao's time, what would they be doing? And he said basically they'd be free to write in jail or be quiet. And that was the openness the Communist Party had to these very deeply held Chinese intellectual ideas.
So this comes at a very interesting time. You know, as I led in, we have all this messaging that's coming out of China, of course, focused on coronavirus, because, well, you know, there's a preponderance of evidence. Every day I'm seeing more and more of it that, you know, I think at best, it was grossly mismanaged and hidden. And at worst, you know, a much worse situation. What in this context, what is the significance of this speech?
Well, basically the way I frame what's happened with the virus is that China's government, either out of incompetence or malice, harmed the lives of many, many, many Chinese people, and then allowed this to spread to the rest of the world, infecting very, very large numbers of people, killing large numbers of people, and killing jobs. And so they're going to face a degree of blowback from that. And the government of China has been revving up its propaganda organs to try to flip the narrative away from where did the virus come from, in what ways did China deceive its people, deceive the World Health Organization, by way of the World Health Organization, deceive the world in ways that very measurably cost lives and jobs, significant amounts. And so they have a significant vested interest in trying to flip this narrative. So they've tried to make everything focus more on how has President Trump personally responded to this, which in some ways is echoing what American domestic political entities are doing, whether it's the Democratic Party or the dominant media. But really, there's a cynical motive for China in trying to do this, and it's just obfuscating the responsibility. Because what's been most remarkable is that China had a good thing going for some time. They were buying influence in international organizations. The One Belt, One Road was buying relationships across Central Asia and Africa and a few other places. A lot of the European countries were essentially very friendly. The government of Canada had been very, very friendly. Then things started to change a little bit with the controversy over Huawei, the detention of Canadian aid workers, the controversies over communications and national security networks, and then the Hong Kong demonstrations. But really with this virus, they've really jumped the shark, where you end up with the leader of Germany, someone who's seen as very mainstream and very open to dealing with China in a conciliatory way, saying very clearly China must pay a price to cover the impact that this has had on Germany and Europe. And certainly in the United States, it's not a Trump issue or a White House issue. Republicans and Democrats across the country, if not in Washington itself, really have a broad base of distrust and concern about how we were misled and the costs that we are paying now. And they see this hostile diplomacy that China is engaged in. They see the mean tweets. They see the very cynical videos that are being produced that are trying to blame America for something that every American, but also every Japanese, every Taiwanese, every Singaporean, every Hong Konger, every German, every Brit, every Canadian, every Mexican, we all know who did this. And again, it's either out of incompetence or malice. There really is no other avenue that this happened by way of China. It's their failed standards or a hostile intent that drove this pandemic outbreak. And so the significance of a deputy national security advisor talking about this now is trying to take away, I think, one of the cynical tools the Communist Party has had, which is to hide its own incompetence, malice, and destruction inside of China by blaming the foreigner, blaming the outsider. And so why would they want to do that? Well, because we know that the number of cases and fatalities and job losses in China are far greater than they have publicly acknowledged. And we saw in the 1980s, leading up to the Tiananmen Square movement, that when you have inflation and mass unemployment, the Communist Party government can be brought to the brink. And so I think they must have real concerns. They saw this political movement in Hong Kong that opened Pandora's box. Now there's a massive economic downturn that I'm sure we don't have accurate figures about. And they must blame the demon on the outside in order to try to hold on to their people. And so Matt, hopefully finding a way to communicate in common sense, appeal to the better angels of Chinese culture and history, maybe, just maybe, can make a crack in that great firewall of China and let that conversation grow just a bit.
Well, that's fascinating. And I, you know, there's kind of two vantage points I want to go with from this one. First of all, there's this, you know, Reuters report where we're kind of looking into sort of verify the document that they say they talked to someone who saw, which is basically saying that the Chinese regime itself is basically seeing that there is a kind of Tiananmen style backlash happening internationally and that they need to kind of guard against or deal with which presumably all this, you know, quote unquote diplomacy is about. So that's one vantage point. The second one, so I don't forget, is simply, it's almost like Mr. Pottinger is basically offering, he's communicating directly with the Chinese people here. That's kind of what struck me with this, right? And that's also something that I don't think I've seen a lot of from high-level U.S. officials.
I think they had wanted to. I don't think that we have had, as I mentioned before, someone of his rank with that level of fluency in Chinese. As I would double emphasize, also with that level of fluency in modern Chinese history, not the fortune cookie version of Chinese history that far too many American leaders and business leaders draw upon, but a real reading of real intellectual and political history over the last century plus. He's a uniquely qualified person to engage in this kind of conversation. If the Reuters report is correct, that the Chinese government fears that they're at a Tiananmen-like moment, and their definition of a Tiananmen-like moment is the world imposing sanctions on them for something bad that they did. And really all of the Jiang Zemin era of Chinese government was first and foremost meant to climb out from under the cloud of the Tiananmen Square massacre. And so it went from that heavy sanctioned China in a recession, probably depression, to a robust, growing Chinese economy about to be embraced into the World Trade Organization. And that was the Jiang legacy. So that's how they look at it. I think they might be right, just in a way they don't intend. I think they might be looking more at a Tiananmen-like scenario from their own people. In that there's got to be exceedingly high unreported unemployment. And the families that have been affected by this are going to feel the pain of that impact for a long time. And I just believe in the current era, it's going to be harder, even though China maintains amazingly effective controls over information. It's going to be harder for them to conceal the realities of this than it has been for them to whitewash the realities and legacy of Tiananmen.
You know, it's interesting. When I think of Jiang Zemin, it's curious how you describe his legacy, because I think of two things. I think of putting down Tiananmen Square, right? Democracy dying same day. You know, my heritage is Polish. Same day, first post-communist elections in Poland, same day Tiananmen Square massacre commences, you know, dramatically different directions, 1989. That is astounding. The second thing is the billion-dollar murder for organs industry that the Chinese state runs. To me, that's Jiang Zemin's legacy.
Yeah, well, certainly the reporting that has been out there on that, it's been enduring. It's tragic in a sense that there have been massive, deep moral problems inside of the Chinese structure for a long time. And as bad as things were in the 1990s, things arguably were never worse than they were when Nixon and Kissinger decided to normalize relations. It was in the middle of the great proletariat cultural revolution. And there was mass murder of people going on in many different ways. There was economic depression going on. It was probably among the worst of times in Chinese history. And yet we chose, for strategic reasons in the Cold War, to lean to a side for the larger battle against the Soviets. And most of my career, from the 80s until now, has been at a time when people basically acknowledge that China has come from a position of tragedy, perhaps evil, in some people, in my view, certainly evil, to one where we aim to try to help lift them out of that state by offering engagement and development. And I think for most of us, and you've interviewed some of my fellow travelers in this regard, we would describe our journey as having been mugged by reality. And that is a saying that was used by Irving Kristol when he wrote the defining book on neoconservatism. And he was a Democrat who, based on Cold War national security strategy, became a Republican, became a conservative. And he said he was basically an idealist and a liberal, but he was mugged by the reality of what the Soviet Union was and the brutality of the regime. And that's what made him a hawk. And so for a lot of us who've worked in government in various forms, have seen the realities of China through our government work, through other kinds of activities, you know, we have been somewhat mugged by reality. And we want that moral story to connect with Americans and move them. But whether it was the Tibetan movement and Richard Gere's passionate speech at one of the big Hollywood awards, or the Taiwan elections and the DPP coming out of relative obscurity to becoming a ruling party, a tremendous development in democratization. You can go down the list of the things that you would have thought would grab the heartstrings. And most recently, the protests in Hong Kong. I mean, 2 out of 7 million people hitting the streets in Hong Kong is just an unthought of proportion of a population. And any culture, and certainly the way people think of Confucian culture or the Asian values conundrum that we had a debate over in the past. But even with all of that, I think it has taken until this virus outbreak for people to internalize, oh, I can't really afford to just coast in my life and pretend like this problem isn't going to come to my household. It's affecting my household. It's affecting my community. It's affecting my country. And I think that visceral awareness has done things that the organ harvesting story, the oppression against Uyghurs and mass internment camps, the Tibetan experience, the house church movement, I think the disgraceful efforts to control the Catholic Church in China, all these things should have caught to the people's heartstrings, but we haven't really been able to pull that together in a way that moved, I think, a critical mass of Americans until really now, I hope and I believe.
Okay, lots of things to think about, and we will see you all next week. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here. And I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.